This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his new book, Letter to a Godchild Concerning Faith, Reynolds Price addresses a question he suspects his students and colleagues often ask about him. How can someone as educated as he is sustain a belief in God's existence? Is this a symptom of his mental blindness or of some other failure of plain intelligence? Price wrote the book as a letter to his godchild. It tells of his lifelong relationship with religion and looks at how the spinal cancer, which left him a paraplegic in the mid-1980s, actually deepened his faith. Price is now in his 70s and is the author of over 35 books of fiction and nonfiction. He's won the National Book Critics Circle Award and the William Faulkner Award. He's a professor of English literature at Duke University, where he's taught since 1958. Price has also been a commentator on All Things Considered. One of the things that first got you interested in faith was an illustrated book of Bible stories. Would you describe the book and what was so powerful about it?
My father bought it for me when I was 3 years old from a door-to-door salesman. I don't know whether they're still door-to-door Bible and Bible story salesmen, but they were around in my childhood. And he bought this wonderful book, which I still possess, called Hurlburt's Picture Story of the Bible. And I had the book well before I could read myself. My parents didn't read to me a great deal. But I thumbed through this very thick book. It was about 4 inches thick. And looked endlessly at these wonderful pictures, most of which were black and white, but some of which were in color. And they tended to be pictures done by 19th century German painters. And they featured lots of sort of semi-dressed women and men, you know, Delilah and Samson and Deborah and her father, etc. That may well have been the beginning of my whole interest in storytelling and narrative, that I sort of made up stories to go with the pictures. And then, the minute I began in first and second grade to be able to read, then I really went to it with the passion. But then I read a huge amount. It wasn't just Hurlburt's Picture Story of the Bible.
What does it do for you when you look at that Bible book now, the illustrated Bible book? Do you get the same, do you get like flashbacks to your childhood or any of the same sensations that you first had when you looked at it?
I literally do get flashbacks to my childhood. And I'm a bit amused sometimes at how amazingly graphic the photographs are. The semi-clothed people, as I said, Delilah and Samson, for instance, being perfectly acceptable as a book for children in the early to mid-1930s. Now, of course, it'd be essentially impossible. You'd be arrested if you gave such a thing to a child. Of course, I should better watch
out. How semi-dressed are they?
Well, not literally, pornographically, but certainly not fully clothed. Lots of unclothed arms, and of course, in the case of men, loincloths of extraordinary economy. No. Part of my feeling about it now is I said, amusement, but. But a lot of it is just great interest. And if you read the text, which is written by this man named Hurlburt, it's amazing how he really doesn't suppress, you know, aspects of the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures that a lot of us thought of when we were in Sunday school as the good parts, that is, the parts concerning sexual relations and incest and adultery, etc. It's right there in Hurlburt's illustrated story of the Bible for children.
Well, this is great. I'm getting the sense that in part this Bible book was almost like a turn-on book for you because it had something of the forbidden as well as the
it definitely
the divine.
Had that. Uh-huh. It had that. My parents were not prudes at all, but I'm never quite sure that they really looked closely at all the hundreds of illustrations in this Bible story book they'd given me. So it did. Maybe it had a bit of a turn-on aspect to it, but then I probably wouldn't have thought of it that way when I was a boy.
Now, you had a vision when you were a child, when you were about 6 or 7. You write about it in your book. Would you describe it?
Yeah. We were living in what to me seemed like the country. It was really only about a mile and a half from the small North Carolina town that we were living in, Asheboro, North Carolina. But there were a lot of pine woods around us and a wonderful creek. And all sorts of animals. And I was essentially alone most of the time because I didn't have any siblings then. And one day I was simply out there at the edge of these woods, and I had this vision, which was really of a great wheel of nature, in which I saw and realized that everything that was, that is everything that I was aware of at the age of 5 or 6 or 7, was all one thing. It was a vision of the sort of unity of nature, and that somehow that one thing was in constant motion and was impelled by some sort of creative power. Now, you know, the language in which I'm describing it to you and in which I describe it in the book would not have been available to me in my preschool years, but that was the sort of, that was the intent and the purpose of what I saw. Interestingly, just in the 2 or 3 weeks since the book has been published, I've had letters from 2 people telling me that they had almost identical sorts of visions in their childhood. They have both said, but I didn't tell anybody this. And I'm certain that I didn't go racing indoors and tell my mother or my father. And I don't know that it seemed very extraordinary to me then.
Well, you know, that's the funny thing about, like, for instance, in Christianity, there's this thing about witnessing, right? So to witness, you'd be, you know, proclaiming this vision. You'd be talking about this vision. But there's also the urge to privacy or secrecy with something like this, because you don't want people to think that you're crazy.
Exactly. No, I published a book a few years ago about the whole 3-year bout with spinal cancer that I had in the mid 1980s. And I had the only other vision I ever had in my life. I'm not a sort of nonstop visionary. I've had 2 in 73 years, so I'm not really a frequent visionary. But the other one I'd had described in this book about cancer, and because a vision of healing, and I've got, my Lord, since that book was published 10 or 12 years ago, I've gotten, I don't know, dozens of letters literally from people who've written to describe to me visions that they've had, perfectly sane-sounding ones, frequently about healing. And they always say, invariably towards the end of the paragraph, they'll say, but you're the first person I've ever told, because I didn't want to tell anyone because I knew they'd think I was crazy.
Would you describe the vision that you had when you had your spinal tumor, and this was a cancerous tumor that went a good deal down the length of your spine? Why don't you describe what your medical condition was then, and what the vision was?
Well, in the summer of 1984, it was discovered. The very large tumor had produced almost no symptoms, and then suddenly it began producing symptoms with great difficulty in walking and using my legs. And then it was discovered that I had, beginning at my hairline in the back, and I have a fairly normal man's haircut, so I don't have the locks of Samson. But beginning at the sort of more or less end of my hairline and down for about 11 inches inside my vertebrae, in the spinal cord itself, there was this very malignant tumor, which had been in there no doubt a great many years. In fact, several of my doctors thought I had probably been born with it, that it was probably congenital, and that it just had developed very, very, very slowly. At that point in American surgical history, and amongst the neurosurgeons of Duke Hospital, it was impossible to remove. They got in about 10% of it and then had to surrender me to the tender mercies of radiation. I had 5 weeks of radiation. I was warned that if I went with the maximum dosage of radiation, which they hoped to give me, that I stood a very good chance of losing the use of my legs. And sure enough, within 3 weeks after the end of the radiation, I had become paraplegic and have remained so ever since. However, a couple of days, I believe that's correct, certainly not a week, but 2 or 3 days before the radiation was to begin, I was sitting up in bed waiting for a friend to come from another bedroom in the house and get me up and help me get dressed. And I just saw myself lying down by a very large lake, which I realized was what in the New Testament is called the Sea of Galilee. And I realized that I was dressed in sort of modern American men's clothes, and all the men who were lying down around me were dressed in sort of Jesus suits. And All of a sudden, one of them got up and came toward me and silently sort of beckoned me to follow him into the water. And I did, and we wound up in this lake up to our waists. And in the way that one often can in visions that I've read about, I could see myself as though I were in a sort of mini helicopter looming over the scene. And I could see my back, and I could see the very bad scar that was down my back and the sort of tattooed radiation lines that had been drawn around that scar for to guide the radiation when that was to begin. And this man, whom I realized was Jesus, was just simply picking up handfuls of water out of the lake and pouring them over that scar. And he said, the only thing he said initially was, your sins are forgiven. And I thought, well, that's the last thing I want to hear right now. And I said, am I also healed? And as though I had extracted it from him, perhaps rather against his will, he said, that too. And he turned and walked away. And that was the end of the vision.
My guest is Reynolds Price. His new book is called Letter to a Godchild Concerning Faith. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Reynolds Price. His new book is called Letter to a Godchild Concerning Faith. When we left off, he was talking about a vision he had in the mid-1980s when he was suffering from spinal cancer. In his vision, Jesus appeared and told him his sins were forgiven. Price asked him if he was healed, and Jesus said, that too. When the vision ended, did you test yourself to see, am I healed? And, you know, did you see that as something like literal and medical or something more metaphoric?
I didn't know what I thought it meant, and I didn't know how seriously I could take it. And then, you know, the radiation began 2 or 3 days later, and rather quickly I began to use the use of my legs. My legs were in bad shape already after the surgery, and I began rapidly to lose the use of those legs, and was paraplegic in a matter of 6 weeks or so after the beginning of the. Within 3 weeks after the end of the radiation. So why did I go through the radiation if I believed that Jesus had healed me in some sense with this vision? I don't know. I had a fascinating letter from a woman in Mexico shortly after I published the book about that moment that included that moment. And she said, why did you go ahead with the radiation, which may have left you crippled, when you had in fact already been healed? And the answer is, I don't know why I did. I did it because all my doctors were telling me to do it. But meanwhile, at that time, one of my most respected physicians told my brother that that I probably had 18 months to live at best. I wouldn't let them give me a prognosis because I knew if they said, you know, X number of weeks or months or years, I'd probably, you know, outrace the prognosis just to prove I could. And that was 22 years ago. I just heard yesterday that I had just passed my annual MRI of my spine with flying colors.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah, those tests are real
thank
milestones.
Goodness. Absolutely.
So when you had this vision, did you tell your doctors?
No, I didn't tell my doctor. And I don't know whom I told first. Interestingly, again, shortly after I published the book about those cancer years and mentioned that vision, I got a wonderful letter from a very old Jesuit in India. And he had read the book, and he said that he trusted that I knew I had had a great privilege. And he said, you have seen our Lord, and perhaps you would tell me, he said, how he looks. And I could only answer in a way that might have sounded scoffing or comical. I said, Father, he looks just like his pictures. Because how would I have recognized him if he'd been 7 feet tall and wearing a Harris tweed jacket and corduroy trousers or something? No, he looked like Jesus in Renaissance paintings of Jesus. He was standing out there. He had no shirt on, nor did I. We were in some sort of clothes that people would wear to wade out into a lake. And he was sort of putting these handfuls of water down my spine.
So he didn't look just like the Jesus in the Bible book that you got as a kid?
A lot like that, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because, again, in that book, he...
Pretty much like the traditional Jesus.
Yeah.
Okay. So, how do you interpret the whole concept of vision now? You know, there's a lot of, like, medical explanations of it, including, you know, like, epileptics are said to have certain visions. There's, of course, pharmaceutically, you know, or, you know, drug-induced hallucinations.
Right.
There are hallucinations that can come with, like, fasting or illness.
Yeah.
So, like, of all, you know, like, how do you interpret the fact that you've had two visions?
Well, the thing that's most impressive to me, if I think about my own visions, is that in 73 years, I've only had these two. I haven't run around the landscape envisioning things. And after I had this healing vision of me being my spinal scar being washed by handfuls of water applied by Jesus, after that happened, I had another couple of years of very frightening cancer, because, as I said, they were not able to remove it surgically, and I had already been given all the radiation I could ever have. And so I was just at the mercy of the tumor at that point. And it got really bad over the next 2 years. But in those 2 years, I never had another consolatory visionary experience of any sort. So my assumption is that the vision came from outside my own sensibility, because I think it had my mind in any sense been cheering me up by inventing a healing vision of Jesus, why wouldn't I have had something else in that next two or three very scary years?
How do you explain that you have this vision of being healed when you still have like two more years of like really serious like pain and cancer crisis, and a whole lifetime following that? A whole remaining lifetime of being paraplegic. I mean, that wouldn't fit the classic definition of being healed.
It wouldn't, no. And I found out that if I happened to be in Lourdes, France, that it would not be accepted as a miraculous healing. You know, Flannery O'Connor went to Lourdes, which I've always thought was very moving, but she was not healed there. She died shortly after going there of lupus, despite her extreme devout Catholicism. I don't explain it. I just know that it happened, and I know that, what is it? I think there's an old hymn, God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform. That's all I could say. And I don't go out on platforms presenting myself as a visionary, though I have indeed mentioned it in two or three books.
Do you think that life would be too unbearable without faith?
You know, I never thought of that, because I never came really close to losing it. I've realized that I was being almost tortured by what I thought was God, if not tortured, but I just went on waiting. I mean, I once, when I was very, very, in very bad shape with this cancer in the summer of 84, as paraplegia was really becoming inevitable for me. And I remember lying in bed one night and just saying, you know, to the dark, how much more of this is there going to be? How much farther is this going to go? And I think if you'd been there with your tape recorder, you wouldn't have heard it. With your own ears, you wouldn't have heard it. But I distinctly heard something that sounded like someone else's voice, a man's voice, and it just said, more. And there was more, and I still think that to some extent that was probably a communication of some sort. But that's it. I mean, I'm not weird. I'm not religiously weird, and I'm about the most unmissionary soul you could possibly find, which is probably a contradiction of saying that I'm religious, but I don't feel that I have any right whatever to go out into the world and try to change the morals and the ethics of anyone else, unless that person is trying to hurt me.
Reynolds Price's new book is called Letter to a Godchild Concerning Faith. He's a professor of English at Duke University. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with novelist and essayist Reynolds Price. His new book, Letter to a Godchild, is a long letter to his godson explaining how he's managed to sustain his faith in God. Price is a professor of English literature at Duke University, has been a commentator on All Things Considered, and has won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Earlier, we talked about two spiritual visions he had, one as a boy, and one in the mid-1980s, when he had a cancerous tumor in his spine. You write in your book, I am one of the least puritanical souls presently alive on the planet. And now I will ask you to tell me something that will prove that.
Whoa. I'm a great believer in joy and a great recommender of joy to myself, my students, my friends, my family. Joy I take to have as its absolute first condition that it not seriously harm another living creature.
So you believe in joy as long as it doesn't harm another creature, and in recommending joy.
Creature.
And is that what makes you the least puritanical soul alive on
the planet? Well, yeah, don't we think of Puritans as having been sort of joyless souls wandering around Salem, Mass. Or Plymouth, Mass. In their gray suits with large Bibles in their hands? I also grew up in the South, which, despite the fact that it's so frequently thought of as the Bible Belt, has got an awful lot of joy loose in it, loose and tied down in the South. And my families, both my families, the Prices, my father's family, and the Rodwells, my mother's family, were much given to laughter and tale-telling and playing lovely pranks on one another. The things that people did in small towns and villages when, there were very few other forms of external entertainment. So they were good to each other in generating fun and joy around them. And I think, that's un-puritanical, I think.
When you lost the use of your legs about 20 years ago,
yeah,
as a result of the spinal cancer and the procedures that you had to kill the cancer,
right.
Did you have to find alternate ways of experiencing joy?
I did. I'm going to say one thing, and I'd like not to go beyond that, which is one thing I had to give up immediately was my sexual life, because paraplegia takes care of that rather rapidly. I had to invent all sorts of other forms. I mean, I had to figure out how to, move across a room. I had to learn how to work a wheelchair. I had to learn how to get in and out of the bathroom, in and out of the shower, just all those extremely practical things, and then on up and down from there. And I said in that book I wrote about my cancer, which is called A Whole New Life, I said, one of the most valuable things that someone could have done for me once I got past the initial shock of the surgery and the radiation would have been if someone whom I could have trusted would have walked in my room and simply said, Reynolds Price is dead. Who do you propose to be tomorrow? Because Reynolds Price was dead. The person I'd thought of as me in so many ways, obviously huge parts of me survived. Thank God. But I had to reinvent, I don't know what, more than 60% of the way Reynolds Price lived and did things.
Can I ask, what are some of the things that give you the most joy now?
being with people I love is primary, but that's hardly new to Reynolds Price and any of his avatars. I don't think there's anything new. It's all the old things, music, theater, being with friends, teaching. I mean, obviously I wouldn't have taught for 48 years if I hadn't loved it. I could certainly have, you know, made donuts if it had come to that. Those are things that immediately come to mind as being very primary, but loved ones, friends and loved ones above all. And thank God I've got a good supply.
Just one more thing. If I'm remembering correctly, in your book, you say that you think maybe you were selected, chosen, I'm forgetting the word that you use, but kind of singled out for this affliction that you had.
That may be the case, because I've often asked myself if I had been presented with, if I could now, knowing what I know about the last 22 years, if I could be presented with a sort of magical retroactive pair of buttons which would say bypass paraplegia or continue with, I feel most of the time I'd press the continue with button, because as difficult as it's been and as painful as it's been, it's been tremendously interesting. Maybe that means I'm the largest masochist you'll ever talk to. But I think I'd press the continue with button.
Reynolds Price, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Reynolds Price's new book is called Letter to a Godchild Concerning Faith.